Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to another episode of Early Work, another isolation special, another lockdown special. Same word, special's the perfect word. This week's guest is Glenn Moore. He is a fabulous stand-up comedian. He was a radio sidekick. He's a former newsreader. Got out of the newsreading game just in time, if you're asking me. Glenn is also responsible for one of the greatest ever jokes on Mock the Week. It was in Series 18, Episode 2. It was about sound guys. I actually looked up the episode just so I could tell you about it. I recommend going to find that on YouTube or something after you listen to this. That's crucial, after you listen to this. But it's proper Hall of Fame stuff. The audience react to it like they're on a roller coaster. They scream before they laugh because they cannot believe what he has done to them. It's incredible. His early work was on brand in its reason for existing, at least, which is that he was forced to write it by his father on holiday so he couldn't enjoy himself and relax. Also in its influences, which is all films, but not necessarily in its content, which isn't really what I'd have expected from Glenn. It was three short stories with some pretty consistent themes, and also one of the biggest twists you are ever likely to hear in any story ever. Trigger warning, this podcast does feature a lot of guns. I hate myself for saying that. But it's a very good episode. Glenn was very funny throughout, so I will see you on the other side. Hope you enjoy it. Today's guest on another lockdown special of Early Work is close friend Glenn Moore. Glenn, for the listeners, is probably best known for having one of my favourite ever chip-based jokes in his stand-up set.
Yeah, they say you're not supposed to pick favourites. Would you like to do the honours? Do you remember the joke?
I think I remember
I'm not
it.
Sure I fully remember. Okay, go ahead.
I think, isn't it something like, my oven broke. Correct me if I'm wrong. My oven broke. So the other day, I found myself doing the incredibly bleak thing of having to heat up my oven chips with a pair of hair straighteners, which is a shame because my favourite thing about curly fries is the shape.
That was it. I think that was word for word what the joke was.
It's not, it can't be word for word, but I'll take it.
No, but close enough.
I remember watching...
I haven't told that one for years.
No, it's a great joke. I remember watching you do that joke in an extra gig in Edinburgh.
Yeah, I remember it was in the caves.
In the caves. And it was quite bad, was it, as a gig?
Yeah, it was. It was really, really, really sorry. One of those shows where you think, like, there's about 20 comedians on the bill at the Edinburgh Fringe, and you think to the audience members, why are you at this show? This is the biggest arts festival in the world. Why have you come to this one? What is wrong with you?
Yeah, I think actually...
And as grateful as you are, you judge them for their decision.
Oh, you go, there's no way I could ever thrive because this audience are... they've been tricked. This is an audience of people who've been tricked.
And you go, I don't, after the show, I don't want to give you a flyer for my own solo show because I don't trust your decision making and I don't want you to now see mine.
Glenn is also well known for when I was getting my hair cut once by my ex-hairdresser, and it will become clear why he's my ex-hairdresser shortly. And he said, there's a famous phrase that comedians get told all the time, especially by hairdressers, which is, oh, you know who I like? And then normally they say a comedian that is maybe the most bigoted or just old-fashioned comedian possible. And
yeah, it's always Bernard Manning, Roy Chubby Brown, Jim Davidson.
The
Holy Trinity.
And then they say, oh, that was when comedy was comedy. But what this guy said is he went, oh, do you know which comedian I like? And I thought, oh, here we fucking go. And he went, yeah, on the breakfast show, on Dave Berry's breakfast show, there's a comedian on that. I think he's called Glenn. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Are you seriously talking about Glenn Moore?
Are you fucking kidding me? You've never told me this. Why didn't you tell me?
I think I told your girlfriend, expecting her to tell you, but obviously she has a power
No, she
play.
Doesn't. No, she withholds that sort of information. Yeah. She doesn't want me to get big-headed. Reese, lay it on me. I want to hear all about this.
So he said that. And then I said, oh, you know, he lives around here. right?
Why did you tell him that?
because we lived very close at the time, and it was local, yeah. A local hairdresser. And I said, oh, you know, he lives around here, thinking he'd be really excited. Like, oh, maybe I'll someday get the opportunity to cut his hair. And when I said, oh, you know, he lives around here, he reacted like, so why would I give a shit about that? He sort of looked at me like, okay. And I was like, well, that is a conversation. Oh. That is how conversations work. I add more information.
Yeah, that's really really strange that he didn't. I mean, look, we're putting words in his mouth. I'm very grateful that he felt that way.
Oh, you're his favourite comedian. Congrats.
Mad.
He also...
Has he not seen any other comedy? Who else did he like? Roy Chubby Brown?
No, this is the guy. He said, it's one of those things where it's like, oh, which comedians do you like? He would ask me that all the time. And then I said Dave Chappelle. And then he said... Oh, tell me some of his stuff.
I can't.
Yeah, I mean, can we go into a private room or something? But yeah. It was, I did attempt to tell him. It's so awkward when someone's got...
You tried to do grape drink.
Yeah, when someone's got scissors next to your head and then you say, no. So they ask you to do something and you say, no, I don't want to. you kind of have to do it. Anyway, I've got a new hairdresser now. So, Glenn, if I had to guess what you were like at school, and I do, because it's the first format point of the show, what I've written is, first things first, son of a Board of Governors member. Then I've put, mayor of the school. I know that's not a job, but most of the time that I'm with you, you seem like you're the mayor of the situation. So maybe what I mean is that you were in some kind of... student political position. I can certainly imagine you
what
doing
do you mean
hustings.
mayor of the situation? What on earth does that? You can't just say that and then move on. You can't drop that hand grenade.
I also think that you were likely to have written some comedy sketches with your mates in sixth form for fun, maybe a student magazine, or even if you had the resources, tried to set up a student news broadcast that parodied both the news and the teachers. And the final point
taking a sideways look at biology.
Exactly. And the final point is oddly good at cross country. Are any of those things true?
Cross country, I was pretty good at, but not great. The Board of Governors thing couldn't have been more incorrect.
Yeah.
My dad works at like an electrics engineering sort of company.
Does the school have lights? Does the school have lights?
Yes, it does, but not as a direct result of my dad.
What else?
I was not the mayor of any sort of situation. I did write my first comedy sketch at school, but that was part of English literature, where we had to... we were put into pairs and we had to pretend to interview a famous author. So me and a friend of mine, Adnan Ahmed, were chosen to write about Robert Louis Stevenson. And so we did it as a Parkinson interview. I was Parkinson and he was Robert Louis Stevenson. And we found that he had some really oddly named people in his life. Like, I think his wife was named Fanny, and his nurse when he was a kid, I think her surname was Cummingham. And so she was called Cummy, Cummy, which for like a 16, 17 year old boy.
To a 16
it was, year old. No, but what we did as part of his sketch was, I would say, and so you were brought up by your nurse, Cummy. How did that nickname come about? And then Adnan, playing Robert Louis Stevenson, would say, well, there are a few incidents, a few sexy incidents. And then he'd sort of like jiggle in his seat. And then the next line was, I was like, and you married a woman called Fanny. How did she get that name? And then he said, there were a few incidents, a few sexy incidents. And then he sort of jiggled again. And we lost our shit right
yeah,
now. That was like, when I was 16, I was like, I think there's a career. I think there's a career in this. But like, that felt great because to be fair, even like the teacher, she laughed at it, but I think she was laughing at just how bad the writing was and how good we thought it was, because we just felt like, oh, it was so great. It was called the Robert Louis Stevenson, The Monkey Behind the Man. Those are the only bits I remember about.
Absolutely ridiculous. I mean, it's such a 16-year-old sketch, and I can absolutely picture the raucous response it would get in a classroom. It's just the context, isn't it? It's going, he said that at school in a lesson. Just getting away with shit. People just think you're a fucking genius.
Cummy is not a feasible name. So like, even like, if I'd read the name Cummy now, I would have laughed, because that's just...
Yeah, Fanny and Cummy, you would find it funny. But the sexy incidents with the little dance thing, There's a few sexy incidents. Good God. Okay, are any of the other things true? So you weren't mayor of the school, but did you run for any kind
In fact, I'd go as far as to say I couldn't have less authority in any situation I'm in.
Yeah, so no, that's another thing. So it's weird. Okay, maybe what I mean is you're running for mayor of the school. It was like
so unsuccessfully running for mayor.
Yeah, you've got a mayoral...
And I somehow get like fewer votes. I somehow get fewer votes than like the joke candidate who's called like... don't vote for Raj, and everyone still votes for Raj because they think it's really funny.
You maybe what would happen to you is you would run a campaign that was built on, you know, good humor, good ideas, but you would have not enough authority for it to resonate with anyone, and then when people got to the polling booth your name was weirdly just not on it. were there any kind of student political situations like head boy type thing, or maybe even prefect?
No, I was a prefect. There were about 10 people who were selected to run for head boy, and I wasn't one of them. And they were like interviewed sort of quite extensively. And then there were prefects and mentors. And so I started off as a mentor, and then I became a prefect. But I don't remember really even attempting to exert any authority. I think I just enjoyed the badge.
So was your vibe at school pretty? Were you pretty happy to blend into the background?
Not sort of blending for background. I remember I kind of flitted around various sort of social groups. There wasn't really one dedicated, like, absolute right. This is a group of three friends who were just like, this is always us. We do everything together. I just sort of moved around the three. It was a very friendly school. There wasn't really sort of any sort of issues or anything. So it was quite easy to sort of flit around. But I don't. I reckon now. I wouldn't be easily recognized at like a school like reunion or get together. I think I'd have to remind people that I went to school with them.
Really? You think so? So you think you're someone who would really be taking the name badge and putting it pretty centrally so that people can see Glenn.
I think so, yeah. And with also a couple of like, it would be like, hi, my name is Glenn, brackets, and remember that time? Like, I'd have to have a few of like specific things that I did that would make
in the way that if you work in a supermarket it says ask me for help, you would have ask me how you know.
Yeah. Let remind you of that time during class civ. Yeah.
Oh mate, well fair enough. Did that manifest itself in any kind of creativity, for example maybe a student magazine or a student news broadcast?
No, we didn't have anything like that. I was at uni, I was the newsreader on the student TV channel Forge TV. And I wrote a few bits for the student newspaper as well. But one was like, the only article I ever wrote for a student newspaper was a review of a Battle of the Bands. And I got the evening was very heavily delayed, and I got so drunk at the event that I slept on a sofa in the back of the room, missed the whole thing. And obviously, this being like 2009, the information of the Battle of the Bands just wasn't available anywhere online because there was like 50 people there. So I just had to like make up the bands and make up like who won, knowing that like, well, no one's going to read this and no one's going to complain.
I mean, that's fucking ridiculous.
I know. And I then worked professionally as a journalist for a fair few years. Yeah,
and this is how your journalism career began. Entirely with you fictionalizing a fucking... I mean,
completely. Like, not even like, oh, you misquoted this person. No, I made someone up. But you can't slander someone if they're made up.
What was your student newspaper called?
That was the Forge Press. So the whole media hub was called Forge Media. Yeah, so this is the University of Sheffield, so it was all very metal and ironwork related. So there's Forge TV, Forge Radio, and the Forge Press.
I actually, as you said that, I can picture the studio at the University of Sheffield Radio, because I think I went on there once to be interviewed when doing a Sheffield gig when I was at university.
The first time I ever saw you was at a Sheffield gig. I saw you perform at a Sheffield gig. Chortle Student Comedy Award 2010. I was in the audience. Joe Lycett was the headline act, having won the competition the previous year. I remember it vividly. That was one of my first experiences of like live stand-up comedy was you.
I believe I didn't get through. I can see why, if that was one of your first experiences of live comedy, you thought, I could probably do this. This doesn't look that hard. Well, better than that. I remember that night. And also, that gig was famous, that Sheffield gig. It was in the Student Union, wasn't it? That was famous, that gig, among the student comedy community for being the best student gig there is.
Oh, I did. I then did the Chortle Student Comedy Award the next year in that room. And that was the first gig I ever did. It's still on YouTube. It was the first gig I ever did. And it was absolutely probably still the best gig I've ever done. I remember every single beat of that gig. It's
just
crazy.
Just to let listeners know, the Chortle Student Comedy Award is an award that haunts comedians for years after because the video clips exist online. So it's one of the first things you do when you start doing comedy, and yet the video clips exist online forever. Glenn is maybe the only comedian I ever met who is like, go check out my Chortle clip. It's the best gig I've ever had.
No, I don't. As in, like, I stand by it. I still stand by it. But it's like, okay, that was my I want people to know that it was my first gig, because that is not said on the video, and I need people to know that was the first ever time I'd gone on stage to perform stand-up comedy. But that room was absolutely magical. In fact, I went back there a couple of years ago to there was this improv group at the university that I used to be part of, and I went back about a year ago just to, I think I was doing a corporate gig in Sheffield, and I thought I'll swing by the student union and see, you know, just see how much it's changed. And I saw that there was this gig happening that evening for the improv group I used to be in, and I was like, oh my god, it starts well before my gig, so I think I might just pop along and see. And so I started queuing up, and the guy who ran the improv group, I'd met him before because he'd come to one of my Edinburgh shows, and he came up to me and he was like, what are you doing here? And I was like, oh, I'm doing a gig tonight, so I was just wondering, I thought I'd come and see the show. And he went, oh, sorry mate, we're sold out. I went, right, can I like stand at the back? And he was like, nah, I'm really really sorry. And I was like, oh, okay, no, fine. And he was like, anyway, gotta go, we've started having like a stand-up comedian who sort of warms up the crowd before it starts, but he's dropped out, so we're gonna have to start the show early. Anyway, bye.
Off,
and I was stood there just like, it was like the end of Dumb and Dumber, and it was like, okay, what is it? Like, I'm asking if I could come in to see the show. I will happily, please let me on stage, please. And so I just got turned away from this gig. And he was like, oh god, the other guy's gonna be really disappointed to find out you couldn't get in. And it was like, yeah, you're the only barrier to me.
Yeah. Oh mate, that's fucking ridiculous. You didn't think to show your alumni card or anything like that, and go show your degree and say, actually, I think you'll find I'm the fucking reason this exists.
He put in the groundwork.
He remembered.
He'd seen me do an Edinburgh show before. He knows I used to be in the improv.
Oh, this is a billion times ruder than I thought it was.
Oh, yeah, it is so bad. Yeah.
So this all came at university. So you were doing improv at university. You then started doing comedy. Not that improv isn't comedy, but you know. You finally tried to get a laugh. And then you were writing for the student paper. You were reading the goddamn news.
Yeah.
And you say that when you were 16, you were writing your first sketches with friends that you had to do in English. What about a bit earlier than that? Were you doing any creative stuff earlier than that?
Yeah, I thought I was just like this child prodigy of creative writing. And my parents, in an effort to keep me and my sister busy, every time I like went on a family holiday or something, we would still, for like an hour every morning, have to do like some maths exercises or like an hour's creative writing and write a story for no reason at all.
Your parents would make you do that?
Yeah, on holiday, like next to the pool. We'd have to just do maths for like an hour.
I remember being on holiday with my parents and being made to write diary entries about the holiday.
Oh, we had to do that as well, yeah. And I'd be like, well, I can just reminisce in my head. Like, why do you need me to write any of this information?
But yeah,
and the thing is, I remember thinking at the time, like, oh god, to think when I was 10 years old, I found that such a chore. I'd find that a chore now. If someone said, write a diary entry for your day, no, fuck off, no. I can't. It hurts my hands so much to just hold a pen. I haven't held a pen for so long that it's agony to write my own name.
So you had to do maths and creative writing. They were the two things, and occasional diaries. They're really just like covering each side of the brain, essentially. So it must have been was the idea that you would develop while still on holiday, not necessarily within school.
I think my parents just didn't want me and my sister to have too much fun. There was still a limit, you know. There's like, I know we're on holiday, but come on.
What sort of creative stuff would you write when you're on holiday?
I'd be given like a sentence, and my dad had a really good sort of sense of humor about it, and had a very sort of like look around you sort of sense of humor in terms of just writing. Giving inset, like it was like a day in the life inside a policeman's helmet or something like that. You just had to write it.
Oh,
or like
wow.
But it would be stuff like that. And then you just have to write a story based on that. So, or it would be like a historical event. And so you had to write about World War I or something and just write anything on that.
Did you have to read them out?
My dad would then like mark them, but he would only ever mark down. It was more just like a spelling exercise more than anything. So he would make a note of like grammatical errors and spelling errors and stuff like that. But I don't think he ever questioned the creativity or like what the storyline was. Because I remember once he gave me Alcatraz, and I remember I'd read a book about Alcatraz when I was about 8. And I remember misreading a bit where it said like Al Capone was one of the residents of Alcatraz. And I didn't realize that resident in this context meant prisoner. So I thought Al Capone like ran Alcatraz. And so it was like some like Bond villain Arkham Asylum sort of thing where like, oh, he, you know, he's got all the bad guys in his prison. And that's, so I wrote this whole story where Al Capone was like the head of Alcatraz and Machine Gun Kelly was like his right hand man. And my dad did not question it. But also I don't know what my dad's grasp of history is. So I think my dad might've been like, fuck, is that true?
your dad going into pub quizzes the next day going,
yeah, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you who bloody runs Alcatraz for nothing. It's Al Capone and Machine Gun Kelly. I mean, that is mental. Yeah,
the only guys who escaped from Alcatraz were just too scared of being criminals.
Your dad essentially was trying to use you to get cliff notes on things that you had read, but you were just, you were a fucking idiot because you were a child. So you were just feeding him absolute nonsense. Oh, mate.
Yeah.
Al Capone, Alcatraz.
But I think I was...
That's such an exciting bit of language for a child.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It was but everything I wrote involved guns and explosions. That's all I could get my head around was guns and explosions. And so, but also I was so heavily influenced by whatever I'd most recently seen. So like when, for instance, like I saw Titanic for the first time when I was about like 7, I lost my mind at it. I mean, it was like, right, I need to write a story about a ship sinking. That's the trick. And it was like, no, write a different thing. Obviously it makes sense to write a completely different thing. But in my head, all I could think about was writing stories about boats sinking. And I was determined to write like a movie about a boat sinking. I was like, well, it needs to be on a bigger scale than Titanic. So what's bigger scale than a ship sinking in the Atlantic? And I had this idea of a ship sinking in lava, and it was a ship that had sailed like into a volcano. And the idea in the movie, it was going to be me as like the main hero, and Emma Bunton, she was going to be like the Kate Winslet sort of role. And at the end, we were going to escape from the ship from a helicopter dangling a chain that we sort of gripped onto. And then because we weighed too much, I'd then have to like fall off the chain into the lava, which is exactly how Terminator 2 ends. And so it would end with me sinking into the lava, and then that was the end of it. And I think I still just called it Titanic. I think it was still just called Titanic, but it was.
I mean,
but it was, and the thing, and I feel ashamed to even tell you, because like, I mean, Reese, you're a good friend, and I wouldn't have even told you that in confidence. Yet I'm telling you this on your on a podcast.
Why don't we go into the first piece? So I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, you've got some short stories.
I have, yeah. Now, with this first one, I'm not going to tell you what it's about because it's got sort of a twist a twist quite early on, which just upends. The rug is pulled out from under your feet.
I can't wait. Now, tell me first. Okay. Before we, a bit of context.
This one's called The Accident.
And
it's
you
called I was given the title The Accident.
Oh, this is one of the ones that you were given the title for by your dad?
I'm certain I was given this one, yeah.
Okay, cool. So it's The Accident. And I'm going to assume, based on previous, that The Accident is the name of an Oscar-winning film that you've just nicked and then written something else about. But let's go for it.
Just you wait. You're going to lose your mind at the twist. Okay. There were 3 gangsters and just one of me.
Strong start.
Yeah, I think it's a great start to a book. I ducked behind some crates as they all got their Tommy guns out and started shooting. Flammable liquid poured from the crates and onto the floor. That could come in handy, I thought to myself and grinned. Can I just stress, that never ever comes up again.
Great,
flammable
that's
liquid
funny.
That I thought was going to be handy never ever comes up. I needed to get away from these gangsters as quickly as possible. I was in deep trouble, but I found a gun on the floor and started shooting at the gangsters. I guess you weren't expecting me to have one of these, I shouted as I killed one of them. His gangster hat went rolling along the floor and rested at my feet. I had the second gangster in my sights and looked forward to killing him. I had the upper hand, but then one of the gangsters pulled 2 electrical cables from the wall and started using them like whips. One of them burst the crate I was sat behind. I quickly rushed behind a red Plymouth, thinking about how lucky I was as I nearly got hit by another electric whip. I must have waited too long, because the second gangster suddenly appeared at my left-hand side. He raised his Tommy gun to my head. "Showtime," he yelled. My life flashed before my eyes, and I fired 2 shots. One was in his arm, and the other was in his head. 2 down, 1 to go, I thought to myself. I went to fire my gun at the gangster with the electrical whips, and my throat went dry when I felt the gun click. I'd run out of bullets. No, I moaned. I thought quickly and threw my gun at the final gangster. Didn't even stop to see if I'd hit him. I ran upstairs and was outside. I breathed a sigh of relief, but that relief turned to shock when I remembered I wasn't safe at all. In fact, I couldn't have been less safe because I was on board the Titanic and it was sinking.
Oh my god, you're obsessed. What was it sinking in? Lava?
It was, do you know what? When I unearthed this the other day, I'd completely forgotten what the second half was. So I was writing the first half and it did come as much of a shock to me as it did to you when it was revealed, oh fuck, he's on the Titanic.
That twist. I mean,
and, it was
and then we
sinking.
Zoom out
but
to
also
reveal.
I thought I was so clever having these like 1940s gangsters having a shootout with these sort of Avengers Assemble-esque electrical whips. Sentences like showtime, two down, one to go, and deep trouble. Like, those are things that kids think grown-ups say.
Yeah.
And, like, that you've never, ever said in your actual life.
It doesn't... I just want to say, yeah, it is actually a huge twist because in the story of the Titanic, the whole gangster shootout thing doesn't come up very much, does it? We mostly focus on the whole ship-sinking aspect of it. But who knows about all the other politics?
Yeah, because... this is covered, I think, in a moment. So here we go. Because I was on board the Titanic and it was sinking. I remembered the vessel had hit the iceberg moments before my fight with the gangsters.
The priorities of this narrator.
When you gotta kill gangsters, you gotta kill gangsters. Okay, there was chaos everywhere. People were running, screaming, fighting for their lives. The lifeboats were crowded of passengers, and with so many people, the captains couldn't tell who was rich and who was poor and who should get in the lifeboats first. They continued to cry, women and children first. Men continued to barge themselves onto the lifeboats, ignoring the pleas. I was embarrassed to say I wanted to do the same. I looked out at the carnage. Dozens of drowned people as far as the eye could see. But there was no time to look at everything. With that, the ship split in half, sending me and thousands of passengers up into the air. The other half crashed into the sea and immediately sank, sucking thousands of passengers underwater. I even saw a boat full of children get pulled beneath the waves.
God.
Boat full of children. This gets really screwed up. Their bodies would later be discovered by divers who thought the dead bodies were dolls and sold them.
Oh my god. Fucking hell. I know
why I put that in there, and it was specifically because in the movie Titanic, which was a bit of an inspiration for this particular piece, there's a bit where when Bill Paxton and his crew are looking at like the wreckage of the Titanic, there's a bit where a light shines over like a doll's head and it's got like both the eyes missing and it's like a doll's head. As a kid, I thought that was like the body of a child, like a dead body, like perfectly preserved under the water. And I remember telling my parents and then being like, no, that's a doll. And then I was like, oh man, maybe someone else could have made that mistake and sold these dolls, and then they later find out they were dead body. And so like that, so there's a whole different story in there.
So yeah, you put this horrific image,
just one sentence. It's horrible, isn't it?
And there's depth to it though. It's dark, it's deep. I mean, it's fuck me. You saying something that dark now, let alone as a fucking 10-year-old.
Yeah, while at the side of a pool, while at the side of a pool in Corfu.
by the way, on the most relaxed time of your year. This is what's going through your head. Christ.
Okay, right. It escalates even from there. I tried to climb the ship as high as I could. Bear in mind, the ship's now split in two. So this side is now vertically in the air. This is subtext. It felt like trying to climb a building. Dozens of passengers lost their grip and plummeted past me. One hit the propeller as he fell down. That's specifically from the film, isn't it? I winced and tried not to look. It was nearly impossible to hold on. And just as I felt like I would fall off, the ship crashed back into the water. We were safe for now. Or so I thought. The huge chimneys that funneled smoke and steam into the air were loose and started to fall. I managed to dodge two of them. They crashed into the water that had started to flood the deck and sent salt seawater over all of us. I was drenched but didn't care. All I cared about was getting out of the dreadful situation and being able to tell my wife what had happened. At least I still had a wife. Some on the ship weren't so lucky. With that, a man came rushing up to the group of us who were huddled on the deck. He was yelling, "My wife just got hit by one of the chimneys. There's blood everywhere." He walked away. "She must have had a lot of guts," I said. Nobody laughed. We stayed. Oh, what an insensitive joke. What an insensitive thing to say. Like the idea that this man came rushing on and went, "My wife got hit by one of the chimneys. There's blood everywhere." And then he just walks away.
How's he walking? Because aren't you trying to climb up a pretty much vertical half of a ship?
No, I don't know if you noticed, Reese, but the ship crashed back into the water.
Oh, sorry, I apologise.
Which prompted me to say we were safe, ... for now. Nobody laughed. We stayed on the ship until it had sunk far enough below the surface that we couldn't see the deck anymore. We were going to drown. I could feel it. It was too late to regret not getting in the lifeboats. The water was up to our necks, and there was nobody to rescue us. I'd given up hope as the water started to fill my mouth when a strong pair of hands gripped me and threw me onto a lifeboat. I thanked the lifeguard. Lifeguards run lifeboats. I thanked the lifeguard over and over again. I was saved and could go back home finally, but I had seen so much death and destruction that I would never forget my time on the Titanic.
I mean, fuck me. There's so much to unpack. First question.
All right, where do we begin? Yeah, go
ahead. You're telling me your dad read that and all he did was correct a couple of spelling mistakes.
Yeah.
Okay, a couple of things I need to ask you about. It takes, after all of this that's gone on, it takes the deck going underwater for you to have the slightest of inklings that you might drown. You suddenly go,
"Well, yeah, because before we were going to drown, I was occupied with the gangsters. The gangsters were there and were, you know, taking up a lot of my time."
Oh, but you've already been through it. Where
the third gangster,
you've climbed up to the top of this ship when it's vertical, watch people plummet past you, and at no point had you thought you were going to drown. And then suddenly the ship crashes back down and starts to sink, and then you go, "Oh, I reckon I've got a feeling we might drown today." It takes so long for that to go through the narrator's head.
In my defense, I reckon in the back of my mind, me being the main character, I reckon in the back of my mind, I was thinking about that third gangster with the electrical whips.
Yeah.
And at the time, I probably didn't know the effect electricity had on water. So, like, he is screwed. He is absolutely, like, he is out the picture.
Well, there's another point, actually. And the electrical whips. Now, is that you pandering to your dad? Are you just trying to get him on side as a reader, knowing that he's the audience? Knowing it suits his line of work for you to be talking about, he picked these electrical cables. Is this pandering?
Do you know what? Maybe that was me trying to be a grown up, because I used to listen to, like, whenever we went to visit, like, my grandparents or hearing my dad talk to any of his friends, they would talk about work and I would zone out. And in my head, I thought grown ups just talked about wires and cables. I genuinely thought that's all they spoke about. And just, like, you've got this plug socket and you put it into that socket. That's all I thought they spoke. That's all I could ever glean. So I think maybe that was me sort of going, and I've added a bit of science in there. So for the grown ups, I cannot believe there's so much stuff that I just forget in that, like the flammable liquid pouring from a crate. That could come in handy, I thought to myself and grinned. And then that's just it.
Well, that's maybe that plays into the twist, because it's like, that could come in handy. It's meant to be leading us down a certain path. Like, oh, the twist is going to be that he then uses that and that's how he saved himself. No, the twist is they're on the fucking Titanic and it's already hit an iceberg.
But, do you know what? Also, Reese, bear in mind, I warned you there was a twist.
Yeah.
So you were like, my dad would have read that blindly and he would have taken... not even like a quadruple check. He would have just reread that about 11 times, being like, "Sorry, did I miss something in the gangster battle?"
Glenn, there's no way that your dad didn't drop the book every time he tried to read it. Every single time he picked up that book, he got to that sentence, dropped it, would pick it up, start again. I imagine he dropped the book upwards of 6 times. You know how when people pitch a film, they'll often say, "Oh, it's like Alien meets the Goonies," or they'll say something like that.
Yeah.
This is Titanic meets The Mask, right? That's exactly what this is. You're clearly influenced by The Mask. You're saying Tommy Gunn a lot. Tell me that you know Tommy Gunn from anything I knew about.
But also I knew gangsters use them. So that's all I could... that was the... And also, the language is quite Mask-esque of, you know, two down, one to go, and Showtime. Oh, he does say Showtime. I think the Mask says Showtime, yeah.
Showtime.
But I thought that was like one of the... As a kid, I thought Showtime was one of the coolest things you could say.
Yeah, it definitely. It really undermines this is true. The detail you put in this is true. But the phrasing you use really undermines their profession when you just say, his gangster hat rolled towards me. It really makes...
I don't know what it's called.
More
alarming if as a nine-year-old I knew the word trilby.
No, of course.
So much
no, absolutely.
More. It would have been more on brand. More on brand, certainly. But definitely, like, more alarming for a kid.
You're right.
I think I used to say showtime a lot. I think every time I went to, like, another kid's party when I was about eight, I think I used to say showtime before I went into the party. I think it was, like, a word I was, like, obsessed with.
Did anyone ever hear you and then call you out on it? Or was it sort of all eight-year-olds are doing that?
No, because I think there was almost like this Truman Show arrogance that I probably had as a kid that I was like, well, someone is viewing this and is able to assess how cool I am.
Showtime to a camera that isn't there as you walk into a party.
Yeah.
You were invited to by default. Fair enough. Well, that is fucking mental. The guts gag is ridiculous.
Probably my first ever joke, I reckon.
You don't really do dark stuff.
I do a lot of jokes that are about dying or funerals. They're always absurd. They're never like bleak or anything like that. But I think because I come across as quite a polite sort of person on stage, I think audiences have quite a low threshold for it. So if ever I even mention a word like funeral, they go, ooh.
Yeah,
go, no,
right.
I
should rephrase what I said, which is I should say you don't really do dark stuff in public. Because we know each other. We've shared some dark jokes that we wouldn't ever.
Yeah, we know about the file on my phone of jokes I can't tell.
Yeah, exactly. Fair enough. Have you got any others? You got another story?
Yeah, I've got this fucking thing right here. This was from school, and we had to write about bullying. And so this is a hard-hitting look. My attempt at hard-hitting look at bullying. And I was inexplicably, I never experienced bullying at school. I was never on either side of it, and I should have been. And I never was. So so this is written completely blindly from a perspective of like a 10-year-old who has no idea how bullying actually manifests. So this is poor stuff.
Does this have a title?
This doesn't have a title. This doesn't have a title as far as I remember. Right. So bear in mind, this is written for school. So a teacher had to read this. Okay. So I think another profound opening sentence. Another day of bullying. Michael was sick of it.
Yeah, fair enough. Another day, another dollar for some. Another day, another bullying for others. Deep.
Michael was sick of it. Just because his friend Christopher didn't like football, he got hit every day. Just because Christopher had his shirt tucked in like he was supposed to, he got thrown into lockers. Christopher knew deep down he wasn't sad, but when everyone called him a saddo every day, it made him think maybe he was. Well, today, Michael was going to scare those bullies and give them a taste of their own medicine. Not with strength or with punches, but with a weapon. Michael had gone into his dad's basement and chosen one of the guns.
Fucking hell, Glenn. I mean, every story. This time, it was a Tommy gun. He looked at the bully and said, showtime, motherfucker.
There's this real Americanification in everything I must have written as a kid where it's all about locker rooms and basements and stuff that we never encountered. And gangsters. I think I read purely Goosebumps books when I was a kid. So it was always these books about living in a suburban neighborhood and a sort of single parent household where it was always Halloween and everyone was trick or treating. And I never had any experience of this sort of stuff, but I would still write about it because I was like, because that's it. That's what I've been taught is interesting. Michael had gone into his dad's basement and chosen one of the guns. Bazooka, too messy. Gun, just right.
Say that again, sorry. Bazooka too messy, gun just right.
Yeah, so bazooka ? Too messy. Gun ? Just right. So it's very much like a Goldilocks and the Three Bears. He's found the perfect weapon.
On the second try.
His dad's extensive military collection. So, guns just right. Michael and Christopher met after school and knew the bullies would block their way home. The plan was Michael would get his gun out. Michael and Christopher walked one after the other on their way home and were nervous but excited about defeating the bullies. They were in the woods when they heard the bullies jump down from a tree. Hello, Sado, said one of the bullies. "Shut up, you stupid bastard," said Christopher, but it just made the bullies laugh harder. It wasn't fair. "Do you miss your mum?" said one of the bullies to Michael. Michael remembered that his parents got divorced when he was a teenager. When he was a teenager. He's in, like, tertiary education.
I mean, Clint, I've got to say, that's almost a bigger twist than the Titanic one. That's an insane twist.
He's in his very youngest, in his 20s.
He must be in his 20s. And he's at school.
I think it's from Goosebumps books. I had, even though the name completely makes sense, I had no idea what a teenager meant. I just knew that people said teenager. I didn't know it meant 13, between 13 and 19. I had no idea. At school, we were allowed to, in our writing, because we'd always ask, like, are we allowed to swear? They'd always say no, but we were allowed to say, you're allowed to say bastard and you're allowed to say crap. So we made full use of both of those. And you'll see this in just a moment. "Do you miss your mum?" said one of the bullies to Michael. Michael remembered that his parents got divorced when he was a teenager. He started to get angry, but just yelled at the bully, "Oh, go lick a crap." I don't know what that means. Lick crap. Crap.
You seem to interpret it as you have to include bastard and crap in your story.
Yeah.
Not you're allowed
to. Exactly. Go lick a crap is not. Oh, I've never really heard like a crap. Like, crap is just a concept. You know, like, I've never heard of one individual crap. He knew he had to reach for the gun now. Slowly, but this is a nightmare sentence. Slowly but swiftly, Michael grabbed.
Oh, that classic.
Yeah, slowly but swiftly, Michael grabbed the gun from his bag. "That isn't a real gun," laughed one of the bullies. "Well, if this isn't a real gun, then how do you explain this?" grinned Michael as he picked up the bazooka. Christopher grinned and said, "You brought the bazooka with you all along." Michael nodded silently and accidentally pulled the trigger. It clicked. It was empty. The bullies laughed even harder. With that, one of the bullies picked up the gun and killed Christopher. Michael screamed as he watched his friend get shot again and again. His shirt used to be white and now it was red. You couldn't tell what were bullet holes and what were shirt buttons. His plan had gone so wrong. The bully looked at Michael and said, "There's one bullet left. Should I shoot Christopher or shoot you?" Michael cleverly said, "You should shoot Christopher," because Christopher was already dead. But the bully fired at Michael. It didn't hit his heart, but it was enough to kill him. Michael died slowly, but thought to himself, "I guess good endings don't happen in real life." That's it.
Glenn, is the message of that if you're being bullied, just leave it?
Yeah, genuinely, because we'd all been told to write stuff about bullying, and I thought it would be really interesting to, you know, obviously not take the side of the bullies, but have, right, these guys are going to show the bullies who's boss, and it goes wrong, and it goes really, really wrong. So, because I remember one of our teachers, a DT teacher, sitting us down in an assembly and saying, like, there are lots of, like, people who will mug you on the school, on the bus home and stuff like that. Never bring a knife to school or anything like that, because they will literally just grab it off you and just stab you. And so I was like, oh, that's, why don't I incorporate that into this? A knife was too small, obviously. So this kid had a bazooka in his
backpack. Oh yeah, it's not exciting for a kid.
And after school brought it out. He brought the gun and the bazooka.
There's a lovely little bit in there about self-fulfilling prophecies that he's not sad. He's called sad. Maybe he is sad because he's called sad.
Yeah, and I Sado comes up twice, which is so 90s. But also, I wrote it as, I didn't know how to write Sado, because I thought, would it come out as sad do? And so I did it as sad hyphen O, like a cereal.
Like sad. Yeah, like but, yeah. The bleakest cereal imaginable. Right, Glenn, I need to score you now. Score all of your work.
Yeah.
On three categories. The categories are originality, pure teen horniness, and Mickey Mouse Club / Ryan Gosling Ryan Goose score, which is how much potential does it show for the star you've gone on to become? How close is it to your work now?
Right.
So, first of all, on originality, well, I'm slightly conflicted.
Well, yeah, but Titanic one falls pretty short, doesn't it?
I'm slightly conflicted because I think it's a really original thing to have been writing, and they've got pretty insane twists. The fact that that twist is in that story is very original, but a lot of what you wrote is just writing scene descriptions of the Titanic. Some of it, bits
no,
of it.
But I think, but so you've got Jaws and you've got the movie Twister, and if you put them together, you get Sharknado. That's an original film.
When talking about Sharknado, would you say this is a true original?
Yeah, fully original. There was nothing like Sharknado when Sharknado came out. There was nothing mainstream like Sharknado that was that so many people knew about, that was that low budget but still aiming so high.
I kind of get where you're coming from. I think the twist makes it so original. You're clearly influenced by movies, but everyone would be. The bazooka, the gun thing. I do find it quite original. Electrical cables, taking electrical cables off the wall to whip people. I mean,
that must have been from Power Rangers
as a kid.
Something. I don't know
that's
what
out of,
I,
fucking, that's what out of nowhere.
Stolen that from.
Plus the idea that licking a crap was quite an original idea. Plus the idea that you wrote a thing about bullying for school and the message of it was tell no one, do nothing, accept it, or you will be shot to death.
You will be shot to death.
I mean, and so will your best friend.
Yeah. Don't bring a bazooka to a knife fight.
I will give you a 4 out of 5. They're all out of 5, these categories.
Oh,
Glenn.
Great. Yeah,
4 out of 5 for originality. Pure teen horniness.
I'd say
nothing. You're not a teenager for a start. There's very little. I'll give you a 1 out of 5 purely on the basis that Emma Bunton.
Oh,
is
yeah.
In
well, she didn't
a different story.
This.
Not in these, but.
I think there's negative horniness from the fact that Titanic's quite a horny film. And that side of it doesn't even remotely feature. I've focused purely on just the ship.
In fact, yeah. So I'm going to do one for the Emma Bunton thing, which I know wasn't in these stories technically, but was in a different story. But I'm actually going to do a -1 for the image you put in your audience's heads of the dead kid dolls at the bottom of the sea that are being sold. It's maybe... You could be the horniest you've been in your life, and if you read that, that would be the antidote to the horniness.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
I'll give you a 0 out of 5 for horniness.
Right.
Mickey Mouse Club, how close is it to your work now? Does it show your potential? Now, it's not similar, but there are gags and little moments of writing that do imply certain things. So I've got to give you some points for that. Also, the opening to, I believe it's The Accident, there were 3 gangsters and just one of me. That's quite a funny, quite a funny little way of putting something. I think it sounds like that was intentional. The rest of it, obviously, is absolutely nothing like you at all. I'll go 3 out of 5 for Mickey Mouse Club. So that's 7 out of 15 is your score for the episode. Pretty respectable score. I don't think you were aiming for horniness, so I think you're all right. Now it comes to the time where I have to read you a piece of my early work. I'm a bit older than you were when I wrote this. I always try and select ones specifically for the guest. I've selected things that I think might anger you because
okay,
I've got 2 poems. They're very 16-year-old attempts at wit and like poetry wit.
Already I'm livid.
Yeah, okay, so the first one is called Toilet Humour. I've got hair in all places, but the farce on my arse is the worst. It's long and it's thin and it travels within. Could it be that my arse has been cursed? But who would expel my excreta? It just doesn't make any sense. For a man not to do what he ought on the loo makes it pointless to go to the gents. There you go. That's the first one. Any thoughts?
Okay. I hate, not the poem, but I hate British twee swearing. Yeah. I don't mean like fuck or anything. I just hate arse. I hate that word so much because it's so...
Me too, by the way.
It's so British movie that needs to appeal to an American audience. You know, the characters and stuff like... Any British film is obviously trying to get a transatlantic sort of market survey. All the characters always go like, where's my sodding keys? And so then you go, no one's ever said sodding. No one says bloody as much as... You think, oh, I just want a bloody crumpet. I've gone in way too heavy. Sorry. I appreciate it. There's a lot of sort of verbal. There's a lot of verbal, lyrical dexterity there.
There's no need to compliment it. I think what I'm trying to do here is a Monty Python. When I was a little kid, my dad used to always play Monty Python's albums. And when it was always stuff like, you know, I've got 50,000 French francs in my fridge. And like little things like that, and then they had the penis song that was like all posh men doing like all different words for penis. I think I'm trying to do that with this, but it's about having a hairy bum at 16. And I just, but this is even worse, right? The next one I'm going to read you is even worse.
Did you have a hairy bum at 16?
Yep, I did. Okay. I remember having a hairy ass at 16. You know, for some people that manifests itself.
And you're all the better for it. You've never looked back.
I mean, it's mad that, yeah, some people would get a hairy ass at 16 and be like, yes, hit puberty. Or they'd be like, oh, I need to sort that out. I thought, well, poetry needs to be written about this. The world needs to hear about this. Okay, this one, I was 17. My kettle's incredibly smug. A pompous and arrogant twit. He'll lean and spit up in a mug and think that makes him Mr. It. He's short-tempered, het up and rude, overconfident, shiny and young. Pushes buttons and he'll blow a fuse, enough so he might burn your tongue. He bubbles and shakes till he steams. He huffs and he puffs and he blows. No whistle, for this kettle screams. I should stick with a pan on the stove. Right, for the benefit of the listener, I'm looking at Glenn on Skype. His head is in his hands.
No, it's because I've been there. I empathize, because what's happened here is you've forced yourself to have a writing day, and you've sat at the kitchen table and you've looked around trying to find something to write about, because under no other circumstances would you ever feel inspired to write about a kettle. Because the issue I first had, again, with the twee thing that we sort of covered a moment ago, is twit. I don't think you've ever said that in conversation.
I've never spoken like this. This didn't represent what I was like at all. This is just me trying to, an exercise. Yeah. Unfortunately, my dad hadn't said, right, your topic for today is kettles, or at least I could justify it slightly.
Because it's not in your voice. It doesn't really feel like it's in your voice, because I'm like, why is teenage you writing about that? What issue could you possibly have with it?
I think at the time, a genuinely loud kettle that used to piss me off, because it was just...
Genuinely, okay, so it did actually come from a place of anger.
All of these come from rage.
Emo song. This is Tom Morello. This is your Rage Against a Machine.
Yeah, but it's instead it's calling a kettle a pompous twit. That's how that's the sort of upbringing I had. Also, I think it might come from when I was a teenager. I remember writing a gag as like a 13, 14 year old that I thought was genius about how I fell out with my iron because he was too hot and heavy. And I said, look, we need to straighten things out, get things in line. Do you know what he said? Shh. Right. I remember I wrote that joke as a joke when I was like 13, and I thought I'm the best comedian that's ever lived.
But that's great. But were you trying to write jokes at that age? Or did that, was that just a fully formed joke popped into your head? Were you like, at the age of 13, were you like, I want to write comedy, I want to write jokes?
Maybe a little bit older, 14, 15, I was like, I was writing loads of gags. Yeah, loads of little gags. Terrible jokes.
I find that really strange. I mean, interesting that it then became your career. But like, comedy didn't even enter my head until I was about 20 years old, I don't think. I'd never even attempted to like write an actual, with the exception of obviously that cracking guts one from the Titanic. But like, I'd never tried to sit down and
all
write
instinct.
An actual...
You just had it in, I don't know. You're just desperate. Anyway, so this, whenever I was writing jokes and things when I was younger, it's because I was just desperate to go, I can write jokes, I can write jokes. And I was always writing sketches and shit when I was a kid, just always trying to write sitcom pitches. I would always rope friends into why don't you come around mine at the weekend and we'll come up with a sitcom. And then like, I'd have a big A3 pad and we'd like try and write characters. But if we did that, most of the time my friends would get bored within 10 minutes and go, why the fuck are we doing this? Do you want to play football? And then fine, we'll do that. And then I'd be like, how about a sitcom about football? And just anything to try and keep them interested.
I get the funny, because I'm always trying to, as a teenager, try and, one of my friends had a decent camera. And I was so determined I'd write whole ideas what we could do for funny videos and stuff like that, funny movies we could sort of make. But actually writing a joke never ever crossed my mind. So I find that I'm actively impressed by 13-year-old you and that iron joke, because it's not even just like a shit pun. It's not like that. It's like, it works. There's like two elements to it. The sh is a topper. The straighten things out thing is great.
So Glenn, I need you to score my writing on the same three categories as I scored you. So first of all, the first one is originality out of five.
Now, the arse one lets us side down, because there's lots of poems about body transformation and body horror and the like, and hair comes up so much that, and it made me feel really uncomfortable, certainly when I was growing up. I just hated reading about that sort of thing. It always made me realise just what a weird concept hair is. So arse hair, absolutely not, but also it came up quite frequently. Now, the kettle, it's not particularly original, I think, in terms of having a rant at something that doesn't deserve to be ranted at.
Sure.
But I've never really heard much or read much literature on kettles anyway. So I'd give you a solid three, definitely. It reads like
three?
A three?
Okay, I'll take that. I'll take that. Next one is pure teen horniness.
I'd give that a one. One, purely because you know what? We're going to bring it up to two. One, you talking about your own ass, it's still an ass. So that counts to some extent. Yeah, that's where your mind was.
Yeah.
Your mind was below the belt to some extent. Then in terms of the kettle, there's so much suppressed rage that you don't know where to put it. And I feel like you wrote that with a boner and you didn't even know you had, but you needed to get those words out of your system, and it was the only thing you could think to sort of write about. And ultimately, the steam from the kettle, is that not the kettle's own ejaculation? There's a lot behind that.
Definitely sexual stuff in there.
So was it about the kettle? Was it just the fact you're writing in the kitchen, you could just see your neighbor openly wanking in the garden and that's when you were like, well, let's make him a kettle in this particular poem?
Oh god, I mean, I don't know if I was doing that on purpose, but there's a chance I would be, given the sort of, given that I was into Python and they were doing all that sort of stuff in their audio albums. There is a chance. So yeah. So what are you going out of five then for teen horniness?
Can I up that to a four? I think I have to. That's got to go up to 4 out of 5.
Okay, 4 out of 5, and then the last one is Mickey Mouse Club, Ryan Gosling, Ryan Goose score. The potential it shows for the future me.
That gets another 4 out of 5 for me. I mean, purely because I know it doesn't feature in your work now, but certainly a few years ago in stand-up, you were still doing poems. And even though you don't do poems on stage really anymore, you've got that machine gun, very staccato sort of delivery that lended itself well to that poem, and I think informs the way you write now. And also, some of your stuff has that sort of middle class anger where you're like, I want to be angry at something, but everything's fine and I've got nothing to get angry about. And I think the kettle one really factors in perfectly well to that. And so obviously I don't think it's like you right now, but certainly on a thematic level, but it's Rhys James through and through. If someone had said one of your friends has written a poem and I didn't know you ever did poetry and I had to read it, I'd be like, that's Rhys. I think that's Rhys.
Yeah, I mean, fair enough. I can't complain about that.
But also, I don't know why someone has stopped by my front door and taken off their hands. I'm afraid one of your friends has written a poem.
Okay, fair enough. So that means that I end up with 11 out of 15, which plays to your 7 out of 15. So I am the winner of the episode. As listeners will know, though, the message of this podcast is that we're both losers. That's the whole point. Glenn, all that is left is for you to play us out with your final story, which we will produce up and put sound effects under, or music, whatever you want, whatever's appropriate. So, bit of context, what story is this?
This is a war story. I must have been about 10 years old, I think. I don't think I'm sure what war it is. There's some levels of research, but generally it's quite bad. And as you can probably guess, with it being the war, guns feature heavily again.
Great. I mean,
I'm excited
obsessed
to hear the production put on this, because this is a proper war scene as well. Okay.
I was listening. You know what? When you were reading the other stories, I was thinking, God, isn't it a shame that we're not producing these ones? Because there's guns everywhere. That we could have had splash noises with the Titanic. We could have had all sorts of stuff in all of them. Think about the bazooka sound effects we could have used. So this, a lot of pressure on this.
I think there's a moment in this. There's a moment in this that is crazier than anything in the other two.
Incredible.
Okay. It was the middle of World War I, and Michael was fearing for his life. His whole platoon's trenches had been discovered, and the Germans were picking them off one by one. There was no way out, and now there was a rumour the Germans were going to wipe them out with one colossal attack. Michael knew he didn't have enough bullets in his Lee-Enfield 303 rifle to murder all of them, so his platoon would really have to help him out. That's a bit of research there, isn't it? The sergeant had gathered the platoon to tell them the plan. "Listen up," he barked. "The Germans are attacking us at some point today, but the problem is we don't know when. Paul, Steve," he pointed as two soldiers by those names ran off, "I want you to cover the sandbags." He pointed at Michael, whose heart sank. "Michael, I need you to..." A mighty explosion cut off the sergeant. "Mortars," he yelled. One whistling missile came down into the guard tower nearby with an almighty crash. That's spelled B-W-C-C-C-C-H-H-H-R-R-R-R. So that's about 12 letters without any vowels. It seemed to cry as it sent splinters all over the place. Steve cried as splinters rammed into his face. He was dead right in front of me. It goes first person for a sec. The sergeant went to go back to talking, but his face was etched in shock. He seemed to choke and splutter as the top of his head slid off in front of the horrified soldiers. Most of them had never seen an X movie, and now they were starring in one. Michael had to think on his feet. Thinking fast and knowing the Germans were nearly here, he grabbed some bottles of whiskey. "What are you doing?" cried Paul. "We're about to get killed and you're going to drink whiskey?" "Trust me," Michael winked. He started throwing the bottles of whiskey into the German trench, but was careful not to be spotted. They waited patiently. Michael heard the Germans laughing. He knew enough German to hear that the Germans thought he'd accidentally thrown whiskey instead of grenades, and now they were drinking the whiskey to celebrate. Michael smirked to himself. His plan was working. Paul still didn't understand and asked Michael why he threw the whiskey away. "Trust me, things are going to go out with a bang," Michael said. On Michael's count of three, the platoon stood up and aimed their rifles into the German trench. "Aim for the tummies," said Michael. They fired their guns and could not have imagined what happened next. The whiskey was flammable, and because the Germans had drunk it, a single bullet in each of them caused an almighty bang. Michael watched in shock as all of the Germans exploded before his very eyes. He walked back to his trench with a spring in his step, feeling the bits of Germans' clothes and blood hitting the top of his head. If he didn't know better, it felt quite pleasant. There were going to be more battles and the war was only halfway through, but Michael knew he'd earned a rest.
Fuck. So that's how it ends. He knew he'd earned a rest.
That's it. Yeah. He blows up the Germans one by one by shooting at their stomachs because they drank whiskey. Because they had whiskey thrown into their trenches and they just went, "I will drink this immediately."
Yeah, they said, "Oh, those idiots, they're throwing whiskey instead of grenades. Ah, well, we've clearly won this one." But they're stupid.
Honestly, the British were just creating blunder after blunder like that in the First World War.
Well, I suppose the propaganda that you'd see of the British now that's international is Mr.
Certainly.
Bean. So you would just think, if there was a war today, you'd go, "Well, they're all Mr. Bean over there. They don't know what's going on."
Yeah, I was raised on a series of German propaganda posters from 1916, and that really influenced a lot of my writing.
There's some themes to your writing, Glenn, that have emerged, which are guns and explosions.
Is guns one of them?
Guns and explosions, yep. Insane plans. Insane plans come up in your things a lot.
It's so crazy, it might just work.
Yeah. Ridiculous twists. Obviously, it doesn't quite compare to the twist of, by the way, zoom out, we're on the Titanic. But there's also the twist of...
I just don't know where I got that plan from. The whiskey thing, I don't know what I could possibly have seen that would make me think that's the science behind whiskey. I don't know. I think because also I obviously had an obsession of, because flammable liquid, you'll remember, turned up in the Titanic one, because when the gangsters shot the crates of Tommy guns, flammable liquid came out. So actually maybe this is a really
long-range call. Is it the same man?
About 2 years ago.
It's the same character. So when he's saying that could come in handy.
It. Yeah, and it turned out the flammable liquid did come in handy.
Oh my God. I mean, the timeline.
Oh, imagine.
Do the timelines add up? Let's try and work it out.
The timelines do add up.
They do add up.
I'd have to be Michael because it's first person in a Titanic. But yeah, because the Titanic was what, 1912 or something? And then World War One started a couple of years after that.
Now, all we've got to do is try and figure out when you've set the bullying story, because he's also Michael.
Yeah, well, there's grenades. Not as grenades. There's a bazooka. There's a gun. Sado. I think that term wasn't really doing the rounds
So the bullying story is the end of Michael's story because he dies in it.
Fuck. But what did we learn? What did we learn about Michael? Michael was a teenager. So Michael is no longer a teenager. So there's a chance that Michael is 90 years old.
Yeah.
And the bullying story happens at some old people's higher education learning establishment where he's being bullied. And for some reason, he's still got access to his dad's basement where there were bazookas and guns. A simpler time. So there's nothing that doesn't add up. It could feasibly be true.
It explains how he knows how to use guns.
Yeah, and also the fact that what really sparked him off against the bullies was that being reminded of his parents' divorce at the age of 90 really rubbed him under the way.
So there it was, Glenn Moore, with one of the greatest twists in the history of fiction. Honestly, I've never not seen something coming to that extent in my life. What a piece of writing that Titanic reveal is. It's like if he'd written Snakes on a Plane, and then halfway through, when they're all fighting off snakes, he just said, oh, and by the way, this was happening on September the 11th, 2001, and these planes were not about to land in their planned destination. Ridiculous. Go and check out Glenn on Twitter. He writes hilarious jokes on there all the time, at the news at Glenn with two N's. Follow him on Instagram at Glenn Roger Moore with two O's. And if you're thinking of messaging him saying, oh, big Bond fan, are you? Have a think if he's heard that joke before. Have a little think. He hasn't, so go and send it to him. Never heard it before. Roger Moore, he's never heard it before. Send him a message saying, are you a big Bond fan? He will love it. He's also an amazing stand-up comic, Glenn, so do go check out his live stuff once lockdown ends. In the meantime, make sure you subscribe to Early Work, give us 5 stars if you liked it, and why not write a little review of it on Apple Podcasts with your actual words and put a twist in there to try and rival Glenn's twist. But please don't make the twist that you actually hate me or hate the podcast or something. That wouldn't be very nice to read in lockdown. It's a tough lockdown. Anyway, I will see you next time. In the meantime, enjoy yourselves. Goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.